Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name is Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of April 10th, 2015. Today we're joined by our frequent guest and prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How are you doing, D.R.?
Good. How are you doing?
Good. So, this past week has been a big one on the international negotiation front. It turns out that President Obama has unveiled a treaty, a proposed agreement, not a treaty, a proposed executive agreement between the United States and Iran to limit the construction of nuclear bombs, basically, in Iran. It's much more detailed and specific than anyone had given the administration credit for negotiating. And of course, in parallel with this, we've had a lot of conservative opposition and actions basically trying to throw, to my mind, both the United States and the president under the bus in favor of stopping this treaty. And I guess I wanted to make the comment that it seems to me there are significant parallels here, or potential parallels, or some sort of instructive way to think about the upcoming negotiations for the climate treaty, which we hope will be signed in Paris at the Conference of the Parties number 21, COP21 in Paris later this year. In both cases, the conservative wing of American politics, or shall we say the crazy wing of American politics, has been telling other countries not to even consider negotiating with the United States on climate because, you know, the U.S. won't live up to its agreements, which is a parallel to what they did in Iran. In both cases, Obama has been quiet. John Kerry is involved, deeply involved in the negotiations. It seems to me that the prospects of a parallel rollout between the Iran deal and what might come to Paris are kind of hopeful. It seems to me, it gives me hope that Obama's administration can go get such a specific deal, even in the face of the kind of crazy opposition that that they're faced. Do you think there's any credibility to that, DR, or am I just wishful thinking?
No, I think there's tremendous credibility to that, and also in both cases, the sort of the questionable, to say the least, attacks on these efforts to, in both cases, create a more peaceful world. You know, there's the old saying, politics stops at the water's edge, and it seems that as the water's edge is increasing, political civility has decreased, and there's this sort of mentality of, you know, sabotage deals that could lead to peace at all costs. What does it say about people who seem to prefer war to peace and warming to reduced emissions?
Right. And I think that, I mean, it is all in a sense political, and whatever the Obama administration comes up with for the Paris negotiations will have to be defended by climate hawks, right? I mean, we will have to be out there saying it's a good thing, somehow providing whatever cover can be provided by individual citizens for the deal, because it's the best hope. I certainly am encouraged by the fact that they got down to such brass tacks with the Iranians. I hope they do the same thing with the rest of the world. It seems like between Mexico and there was a country in Africa that put up their ante into the negotiations last week. That's all good.
And I believe there was a report that came out on April, I believe April the 8th, that Japan is now promising to reduce their carbon emissions 20% by 2030. So you see how the United States' leadership has led to this sort of domino effect of all these major countries, Mexico, China, Japan, now saying that we are going to step up. You know, again, if America doesn't lead, who will? That's the key question. And when you see people trying to block America from leading, that is just unforgivable.
Yes, it is. I mean, there are words that come to mind that are punishable offenses, but I don't think politicians are subject to those things. Anyway, so despite the fact that no one else in the media has mentioned it, you heard it here first. There's a connection between the climate treaty and the Iranian treaty, which I think is a good one. But then there was another article speaking of the sort of dead ender. What was the Cheney phrase? Dead enders in Iraq, the dead ender opposition to the Obama clean energy plan to try and get states to not make a plan. Okay, just sort of reminding me, President Obama last year put out a plan. It's actually Gina McCarthy led the plan to cut carbon pollution by 30% by the year 2030, but that plan required individual states to prepare a plan, or it asked individual states actually to prepare a plan that best suited their local needs to reduce their carbon emissions by a certain amount. And of course, it turns out that each state has a different target because each state has different capability to reduce carbon and it produces different amounts of carbon. I think here in the Northeast, we have been asked to reduce more carbon because we're farther ahead. We have more technology, whereas places that are heavily dependent on coal may not have to be as aggressive as Massachusetts. But long and short of it, people in the Senate have been asking states to refuse to make that plan as a way of opposing the president's overall plans, so that each state would refuse to make, sort of like the healthcare thing, right, where the
Exactly.
states refused to set up the healthcare exchanges. And so tell me, DR, after that long preamble, there was an interesting article by Joe Rome in Think Progress, which basically ties up the EPA, these state-by-state carbon plans with the crazy, insane Religious Freedom Restoration Act in Indiana last week, right? What did Joe Rahm have to say?
Joe Rome in a brilliant, brilliant piece that appeared in the April on April 6th on thinkprogress.org. He basically talked about, the parallels between the citizen uprising against the anti-gay bill in Indiana and the need for a citizen uprising against states that refuse to comply with the EPA carbon pollution standards, and basically saying that, this has to be this basically has to be the front line of the fight for a livable climate, that, that there's going to that there has to be a citizen condemnation and a citizen pushback and a strong, forceful pushback, possibly up to and including economic boycotts against states that basically, stick their middle fingers in the faces of the EPA and refuse to do anything to cut carbon pollution. I noted previously in a previous edition that what the people who are trying to push for state abandonment of EPA climate protection efforts, what they're doing, they're borrowing a tactic from the segregationists of the 1950s and 1960s, who embraced a policy of what was known as massive resistance, where you basically try to sabotage any effort at desegregation, any effort at integration of schools and lunch counters, and how these actors today are borrowing 50-year-old tactics on the 50th anniversary of the march from Selma to Montgomery, and how the same immorality that was on display in the 1950s and 1960s in terms of trying to block efforts to reduce discrimination is on display today in terms of trying to block efforts to reduce pollution, which is going to discriminate against all of us.
But I mean, I guess I mean, I number one, I agree with you, but I think you have an even older weapon than the ones that the bad guys are using. But I mean, I think it was Captain Boycott in the during the time of the American Revolution who they started boycotting English goods, right? That's where the word comes from, the guy who first proposed the boycott. But if, for example, you're in a situation where certain states don't put up aggressive carbon plans as requested by the administration, a state like Massachusetts could refuse to do business, or refuse that you could have campaigns that refuse to go to I don't know. Who knows where Texas, if they don't have a clean energy plant, right? That economic power, which is sort of similar to what's happening in the Indiana religious freedom case, if that gets redirected by climate hawks at states that aren't playing along, that's a powerful weapon, I think.
Exactly, because you know, with so many of these sort of elected officials who, you know, while claiming themselves to be persons of faith, they always bow down to the almighty dollar. And if they see the almighty dollar going out of the window, they might decide
They
to
might
change
change
their
their
minds a little bit.
right. Money talks. Now tell
Exactly.
me, I heard that there was another edition of the Year of Living Dangerously coming up.
Yes, Joe Rome was actually discussing his April 6th piece on the April 8th edition of Brad Friedman's Bradcast, which is broadcast on KPFK out in California. And he mentioned in terms of this in this interview that they are in fact going to do another edition of season two of Years of Living Dangerously. He said that he could not acknowledge what the at this time what the cable channel it would be on, but it would have a broader reach than Showtime, the cable channel that ran season one, and that it's scheduled to be on the air in 2016.
So, in my Years of Living Dangerously is a TV series that was on Showtime. It was, what, 10 episodes that ran
Nine
last year?
episodes that ran from April 2014 to April to June 2014. In fact, I believe April the 13th would mark the first anniversary of the airing of Years of Living Dangerously, and it was just a great piece, just a completely flawless series, and it's very good to see that season two is on its way.
So when you're done binge watching Game of Thrones, you can binge watch Years of Living Dangerously, huh?
Exactly.
So then there's one other sort of idea that's running around this over the last 10 days or so, and again it has to do with climate denialism. But Dana Milbank in the Washington Post wrote an interesting article talking about the fact that climate denialism is all of a sudden in some kind of retreat, and that there may be a big shift going on. That since Americans are less and less receptive to this idea of saying, I am not a scientist, that the game is changing. People aren't talking the way they used to. Did you get a chance to read that article?
It was a great piece by Dana Milbank, and an even greater piece was written in response by David Roberts of Grist, who noted that because Dana Milbank has this reputation of this sort of I guess he's considered sort of like the new David Broder, and sort of the person who embraces the ethos of faux centrism and basically deference to beltway thinking. In at the Washington Post, and he noted that when a guy like Dana Milbank, with his reputation, acknowledges that climate change denial is on the downfall, that means something. David Roberts says that doesn't necessarily mean that the folks who are known to promote climate change denial are ready to embrace solutions, but nevertheless, it does say something about the shifting politics of this issue that the narrative from the citadels of climate denial has shifted from calling it a hoax to basically saying that potential solutions are going to be too expensive.
And I think that's an interesting, and to me, the nub of the point. And again, Dave Roberts hits it on the head. He basically saying that the deniers are going to potentially abandon this whole thing about science, and I'm not a scientist. And what they're going to fall back on is the same thing they've fallen back on for the last 50 years, which is to say the regulations cost too much money. We can't do it. It's too expensive. I remember when I was. I mean, I can remember a time when there were not seat belts in cars, right? And I was old enough to be reading Newsweek, and GM was saying, "Oh my God, seat belts are going to cost another $100 per car, and that's going to kill our business." And of course, people have had seat belts and now airbags, and it didn't ruin anyone's any economy. Same thing with the Clean Air Act. I mean, they complained it was going to destroy the economy, and of course, we're better off now than we ever were. But I think Roberts makes the point that every time these people make the argument that the regulation is too costly, it's like no one ever heard it before. It's a new argument. Everyone's surprised. It doesn't have to drag along the burden of failed argumentation from the last 50 years, but still in all, it's an effective argument that the climate deniers are going to use to block regulation. So the message that I have for climate hawks who might be listening is to put your seatbelts on, so to speak, get ready, because this is potentially the new front. It's all going to be about how expensive it is to stop global warming.
And the thing to note is that, you know, once you have these measures implemented, and when when the reality makes it clear that they in fact work and they are cost effective, all of a sudden the narrative from the forces of denial will be to say that, hey, you know, it wasn't that big of a deal, and just to deny that they ever denied. And I think Media Matters years ago pointed out that back in the 1970s, the Wall Street Journal editorial page would go on and on and on about how we couldn't have anything done about the issue of acid rain, that would kill the economy to address acid rain. But in July of 2001, the Wall Street Journal ran an editorial praising cap and trade as having solved the acid rain problem, and suggesting that cap and trade would be more preferable to that which was demanded in the Kyoto Protocol as a means of reducing emissions. So it's like the narrative changes from denial of the solution to denying that they denied the solution.
And they get away with it every time, and it's up to people with a clear head to drag up the failed arguments of the past and make sure that everyone understands how spacious these arguments are, that the economy is going to collapse if we take an action that's for the good of us all.
Exactly. And the other example too is how in the early 1960s people thought that, you know, Medicare would destroy the economy, and now Medicare is like the gold standard of something that works and has tremendous benefits and hasn't hurt the economy at all.
Well, we will be back to report on the first climate denier who starts talking about blocking the cost of regulation, because you'll hear it here first. Mm-hmm. Anyway, D.R., we're going to leave it there. We'll tell our listeners they can check out the links to most of what we talked about out of the blog. It's massclimateaction.wordpress.com. Please leave us a comment. You can find us on Facebook at @massclimateaction. You can listen to the show, share us with your friends, like us, do all the typical Facebook things. You can listen to us directly on your smartphone using Stitcher. You can find us on iTunes if you search for Massachusetts Climate Action. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out, we must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. Thanks for being here, DR.
Thanks.
And thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time, be green.
Very cool.